This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The implications of the divisive wall. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend, and here's what we have for you this hour. The fight over the border wall isn't just about a physical wall, it's about a cultural divide as well. Bible school and public schools, some Christian lawmakers are pushing a wave of bills to make it so. Need help finding your soulmate? Maybe a dating coach can help. And the race is on in the Best Picture Oscar category.
The Best Picture, average Best Picture gross was the highest it's been in a decade. Best Director was the lowest it's been in more than 20 years. Two of the Best Director nominees are the directors of Roma, which is a Netflix movie that for which they didn't report any grosses. And another film nominated for Best Director but not Best Picture is Cold War, that has so far grossed less than $1 million.
Ben Fritz of the Wall Street Journal will be here in about 20 minutes with that story. As the partial government shutdown drags on and federal government workers missed a second paycheck on Friday, we're no closer to resolving the fierce debate over a physical wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. But is the fight really about a wall, or is it about something deeper? Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at the Wall Street Journal, has taken a look at this contentious issue and has discovered it's about a lot of stuff. Jerry, how is this battle about more than just a wall?
Well, it's really more about a sort of a cultural divide in America in a lot of ways. And this has become more acute as the two sides dig in harder, and Democrats have gone from saying, you know, some money for some border security to no money for a wall at all. And President Trump has become absolutely adamant on $5 billion plus for the wall. And really, for their core supporters, this is really as much a fight about the vision for America in the future, people who are comfortable with a kind of a more diverse, cosmopolitan, and melting pot America versus people who think this is just one more trend they don't like and it's changing the complexion of the country they love. And so for both sides, the wall is kind of a symbol as much as a reality about what kind of America is really going to emerge in the 21st century.
Regarding the cultural divide, are people's attitudes toward illegal immigration the biggest example of division?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, there are attitudes about immigration in general, then there are attitudes about illegal immigration specifically, then there are attitudes about whether the wall is a good idea or not create border security, which everybody, at least in theory, says that they want. And I think the reality is that if you look at core Trump supporters, you find generally less enthusiasm about immigration and immigration as a force that improves America or that strengthens America, that the diversity that it produces is good, not bad. People who supported for Hillary Clinton, for example, are much more likely to agree with that notion, and people who supported Donald Trump are more likely to disagree with that notion. That's what we found in our Wall Street Journal, NBC News polling, in any case. And Trump supporters are less likely to think that the Dreamers, the young immigrants brought here illegally by their parents through no decision of their own, ought to be given a path to citizenship. Trump supporters are less inclined to support that. Democrats and Hillary Clinton supporters are far more likely to support that. So there is a kind of a difference that transcends just differences about the wall and goes to kind of questions about the value of immigration and exactly what kind of attitude the U.S. should take toward caravans of Central Americans who come across the border seeking asylum.
Regarding that 2017 poll that you referenced, not surprising, I guess, that there are also some noticeable differences concerning attitudes about immigration in terms of the age of those surveyed.
Yeah, you do. You see, and this has been consistent over our polling the last couple of years, that young Americans are much more likely to embrace immigration and kind of a diverse, even multicultural society, and older Americans are less likely to embrace that. And that, again, tracks the divide between, and this is a generalization or maybe overgeneralization, but there's a similar divide between Trump supporters, who tend to be somewhat older in toto, and Trump and enemies or foes who tend to be younger. And so there is a divide between the two kinds of America that people want that falls out along age lines as well as other divisions.
Did we see anything at all change from that mid-2017 poll to the 2018 midterm election or not?
Well, I don't think attitudes have changed all that much. I think you could see if you go back to the polling we did in 2017 when the Trump-era debate about immigration and the wall really first got started, and fast forward to today, and you can see all the seeds of the debate. I think what's happened, though, is that both sides have kind of hardened their views, that there was a compromise that was available in 2017 and then again in 2018 that envisioned Democrats supporting some money for a border wall while in return getting some legal permanent legal status for the Dreamers, for example, the two core elements of a compromise. Well, that compromise isn't really acceptable to either side right now, or at least to sort of hardliners on either side. Trump supporters see legal status, permanent legal status for Dreamers as being amnesty, and the newly, and this is I think the biggest change, the newly energized progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which helped Democrats take control of the House, now sees no reason to compromise at all on wall issues with President Trump. And so I think the lines are similar for the last couple of years, but I think the hardening is the new phenomenon we're seeing. And in fact, normally you have debates about immigration and the potential harm from immigration, legal or illegal, at a time of economic stress in the country when people worry immigrants will take jobs or drive down wages. That's pretty much disappeared from the debate. You know, the economy is so good and businesses, in fact, are looking for workers, including immigrant workers, that those arguments are hard to sustain. So the president doesn't emphasize those much. Instead, he is framed the debate about the wall as a humanitarian and a security crisis on the southern border. We talked about crime and drugs and illegal behavior generally. And on those grounds, he is saying we have a crisis at the border and have to control the flow of immigrants. And, you know, I think, again, most people say they're for security at the border. The question is a wall part of that or is it the entirety of it? And how important is it really in the panoply of things to worry about?
Jerry Seib, Executive Washington Editor at the Wall Street Journal. It's 13 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Proposals from lawmakers in at least six states would require or encourage public schools to offer elective classes on the Bible's literary and historical significance. Here to discuss this wave of Bible literacy bills, USA Today's Aaron Richards. Aaron, what's behind this push for what amounts to Bible classes in public schools?
There's a number of conservative lawmakers across the country that are saying, look, the Bible has a lot of literary, social, and historical significance. We think that these classes should be offered as an elective. Even if schools already have world history courses, we'd like this class to focus more exclusively on the Bible and its significance in certainly American history and the development of our, sort of the social development of our culture. But in reality, there's also several larger groups that are Christian political groups that are strategizing and offering some model legislation on these bills, which is why so many of them look pretty similar from state to state.
Doesn't this get really close to crossing the line regarding the separation of church and state?
Well, it depends on where you sit on the issue. The people offering the bills think that these classes can be offered in a way that doesn't overstep the constitutional line between dividing church and state. So, for example, in public schools, you can teach about a religion, but if you are teaching students to prefer one religion over another, that's a no-no. So the lawmakers say, hey, look, we can do this in a way that doesn't overstep that line, but then you've got a lot of people on the side of advocates for making sure that, you know, religion stays out of public schools that are saying, hey, this is a slippery slope. Even by offering these classes that are exclusively focused on the Bible, you're really signaling that you do have a preference for this particular faith.
Tell me about Project Blitz.
From what we can tell, Project Blitz is a coordinated effort from several groups, a group in Texas called Wall Builders, which is a nonprofit, and another couple of groups around the country, the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation and the National Legal Foundation, that have put out some literature that offers some model legislation around what they call religious freedom or religious liberty. A lot of the model legislations are ways to direct policy that tries to restore what many people would call traditional values in the public space. So, for example, there are some model bills around offering or requiring schools to have students take the civics exam for citizenship. And a lot of these groups are really, they want to see more of a focus on conservative values and students understanding the moral teachings of the Bible. And they're really quite intent on showing people how what they believe the founding fathers wanted our country to look like. And so they're pretty, they are conservative Christian views. I think, even when I was covering a civic literacy bill in Wisconsin a year or two ago, I didn't realize that it was actually part of a larger strategy. That model legislation is laid out in this playbook.
Are all the current proposals similar in nature?
They are. They all either encourage schools or require schools to offer an elective on a Bible studies curriculum. In addition, there's a number of bills that require schools to post the national motto, "In God We Trust." And, that for many people, that's not that big of a deal, right? It's not interfering with the normal activities of school. But the ACLU and other groups that are pretty concerned about separating church and state are saying, look, this is also kind of signaling a preference for, Christianity in public schools. And so that's why most of these bills are looking pretty similar. Although I talked to one lawmaker in Indiana who said he'd never heard of Project Blitz, and, this was something that he came up with totally on his own, wasn't influenced by other people in developing his bill around Bible literacy and the In God We Trust display.
USA Today's Aaron Richards. It's 21 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Was your favorite movie nominated for an Oscar this year? Maybe, maybe not. As this weekend's Jim Chesko tells us, it's an especially unusual year in the Best Picture category.
In something of a change of pace this year, many of the movies that received Best Picture nominations from the Motion Picture Academy are flicks that a lot of filmgoers have actually seen. But none of the three highest-grossing movies that were nominated received Best Director nominations. On the line to discuss all of this fun film stuff is The Wall Street Journal's Ben Fritz. Ben, is this unusual that these two big categories are sort of out of whack with one another?
Yeah, it is. We actually looked at the grosses over the years, and typically if you look at the grosses, the average gross in the movies nominated for Best Picture and Best Director, they track pretty closely, the reason being they're mostly the same films. This year, they diverged wildly. The Best Picture, average Best Picture gross was the highest it's been in a decade. Best Director was the lowest it's been in more than 20 years. And the reason for that is in Best Picture, you had huge successful movies like Black Panther.
I waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all.
And Bohemian Rhapsody and A Star Is Born.
You write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Well, because like almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
The directors of none of those films were nominated for Best Director. Instead, two of the Best Director nominees are the directors of Roma, which is a Netflix movie that for which they didn't report any grosses, but they're presumably extremely low. It was in only a handful of theaters at the same time you could stream it at no additional cost on Netflix. And another film nominated for Best Director but not Best Picture is Cold War, which is a black and white Polish film that has so far grossed less than $1 million.
Now, I know there were various issues with the director of Bohemian Rhapsody, but you mentioned a couple of the other big ones, Black Panther and A Star Is Born. They certainly didn't direct themselves, and they got generally great reviews. So were Ryan Coogler and Bradley Cooper snubbed in the director category?
I mean, a lot of people think they were. Ryan Coogler, people weren't sure if he'd get nominated, frankly, just because Black Panther is the first superhero film to even be nominated for Best Picture. So that's a big deal in and of itself. And to also get Best Director would have been even more of an accomplishment, more surprising, I think, for superhero fans, more of a wonderful surprise. And, don't forget, there can be up to 10 movies nominated for Best Picture. This year there were 8, but there are always 5 Best Director nominees, so it was going to be tough for him. But for Bradley Cooper to not be nominated shocked a lot of people. A Star Is Born has long been a favorite to win Best Picture and to really be the big winner at the Oscars this year. So it was very surprising to see a movie that's a favorite at the Oscars overall to not even get a Best Director nomination.
So in your article, you suggest that we take a close look at these lower grossing films connected to the Best Director category to perhaps figure out, you know, which Best Picture nominees have the best chance of winning. These are the directors who did Black Klansman, Cold War, The Favorite, Roma, and Vice, as you noted. I've seen only The Favorite and Vice of those five. So tell me more about the directors here, including Spike Lee with Black Klansman, and what the prospects are now for the directors in that category.
Sure. Well, you know, Spike Lee is a huge accomplishment. He's been, you know, a major force in film directing for 30 years now, and this is his first time being nominated for Best Director. So it's a really big deal for him. You know, Black Klansman is very well liked in Hollywood. It got extremely good reviews. And, you know, it would be an amazing recognition, not just of that movie, but I think of his career if he were to win. In Roma, you have a director who's won before, Alfonso Cuarón. He won for Gravity. But this is a Netflix movie that, you know, the vast majority of people, virtually everyone who's seen it, has seen it streaming on their TV or other digital device. You know, it had a very, very limited theatrical release. So it's kind of... It would really say something. You know, the Oscars are supposed to be about honoring movies and movie going, and this is a movie, but it's not a movie that you see in a movie theater. So that would be, it would really kind of be a transformation of the way Hollywood thinks about movies, the way Oscars think about movies, if they were to honor Cuarón for this film. Perhaps he'll win Best Director, but they won't give it Best Picture, because, you know, it is a well-liked film, and he's a well-liked director, and it's a great movie by most people's estimation. So they're really grappling, I think, with what to do with it. And then in Cold War, you have a film that's really well-liked. I mean, it got rave reviews, and you have a director, he's not well-known here, but, you know, by cineasts, let's say he's very, very well-known and respected.
Ben Fritz of the Wall Street Journal with this weekend's Jim Chesko. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
I used to leave voicemails for myself because the only one I could trust to get something done right was me.
Hey, you, it's me. Remember to order safety goggles and grab some milk on your way home.
But now I use Grainger. Grainger's got the technical support you'd expect from America's number one source for industrial-grade supplies. They're in the business of helping my business. So no more talking to myself. Now I talk to Grainger. Because when it comes to keeping your business running, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Some of our top stories: how a dating coach may be able to help you find your soulmate. A look at the strategies that can protect you from future financial pitfalls. Why it's getting harder to find a hotel room you want. And a great way to boost your mood, and it only takes a few minutes. That story in about 20 minutes. Had a string of lousy dates lately? Maybe a coach can help. This weekend's Gordon Deal has the story.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal, and she's got a piece entitled, Can a Dating Coach Help You Find Your Soulmate? All right, set this up. First of all, what are dating coaches?
So dating coaches are people you might hire, a sort of life coach, but you hire them to help you with a very specific issue, in this case dating. So people who feel like maybe they haven't dated for a while, say they're getting divorced or they're widowed or things aren't going well, they just aren't getting the kind of responses they want, or they feel like they aren't dating well, can get a dating coach. But also people might want a dating coach if they're dating somebody and they want to know, I don't know, I have to decide if this is the right person. And that's another reason why somebody might get a dating coach.
Is another nickname for a dating coach a wingman, or is this different?
A wingman's your friend you get to take out with you, so that it's your better looking friend for all the people over.
isn't this roughly the same advice you're seeking, though, or no?
Well, that's it. You can get your friend, sure. You can ask your mom for dating advice if you want. I don't always advise that, because here's the thing. Your friends may not have the best advice. Maybe they haven't dated for a long time. Maybe they're, you know, partnered up. Or maybe they're not any better at it than you are, don't really have the answers. And these dating coaches are not all of them, but many of them very trained. So in the dating coach world, you want to be careful, because you could find somebody who, you know, managed to get married and now thinks that they have all the answers and, you know, are going to charge you to tell you how to get married or how to find your soulmate. But there are many therapists who have gone into coaching. They like it. It's you know, an upbeat, interesting part of their work. So there are many people who really understand psychology who go into coaching. And then there are coaching training programs. Now, here's the issue. You don't, as a dating coach, you don't have to be certified in any way. So you could, like I said, if you didn't do your research, you could find somebody who doesn't really know what they're doing. But there is a lot of training out there, and so hopefully if you do get a coach, you're going to get one who's good, who's got some training and knows what they're doing.
What are the costs, or how do you pay?
You know, Gordon, I didn't ask that question because I did ask that question, frankly, but nobody wanted to answer it, like none of the coaches. So I can tell you the way they do it if you want to ask that, like how does it work?
Yeah, so is there some sort of a pricing structure for a dating coach?
Sure, usually you can go on and sign up for a number of weeks, and a lot of them have programs where that sort of program that you go through, you get some one-on-one time. You can reach out with questions. Often you get some group time with some of their other clients. There'll be weekly conference calls where you can sort of go over your dates and get feedback and advice from other people as well as the coach. And, you know, they also often have videos and written material that they've drawn up so that give advice and give some information that you may find helpful.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about her piece entitled, Can a Dating Coach Help You Find Your Soulmate? Now, these are significantly different from, say, therapists.
These are different from therapists because therapists are licensed for the most part in their field. If you're a psychologist, you know, you're required to be licensed in most states. So, but therapists are trained to diagnose and treat mental disorders and mental illness. And so that's what they're working on. So a dating coach is not. They're working on helping you. Also, therapists are going to help you with the past. They're looking at what's happened in your childhood, what's happened in your past, and all of your history to see how that affects how you're behaving in the present. That's not what a coach is doing. A coach is looking at your present behavior. How did you behave on that date? How did you ask that person out? How did you, you know, respond when they asked you out? And then there's coaching you, like a sports coach would, on doing it better.
Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal with this weekend's Gordon Deal. It's 21 minutes before the hour. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. We may not be able to predict the future, but we can financially plan for it. So says Jonathan Clements, former personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal and the founder of the website HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, how are we doing when it comes to managing risk?
When it comes to managing risk, most of us are doing an okay job, but many of us aren't. For instance, if you look at parents with children under the age of 18, one-fifth of those people do not have any life insurance. That's clearly a huge risk. If you're the family's main breadwinner and you go under the next bus, how is your family going to cope financially? And normally the answer to that is you need life insurance. If you don't have it, you probably should get it.
Is that only for people with children?
Generally, yes. If you have children, that's the key reason to buy life insurance. The other reason to buy life insurance is if you have a spouse who doesn't work, you'd want to have some life insurance so that he or she could get back on her feet financially. The only other people, and this is a tiny, tiny minority of the population, if you have a big enough estate so that state taxes could be an issue, in that situation, yes, life insurance may be an issue.
Jonathan, let's continue on with the insurance part of your story. What about long-term health insurance?
If we're talking here about long-term care insurance, most people, when it comes to long-term care insurance, you know, have one of three possibilities. One, they could buy insurance. Two, they could plan to pay out of pocket. Or three, they could plan to deplete their assets, then fall back on Medicaid. Very few people are buying insurance these days. The best figure I could find was that only something like 16% of retirees have long-term care insurance. Among the other 84%, a small minority could afford to pay for long-term care out of pocket, but for the vast majority of Americans, you know, what they're going to end up doing is depleting their assets and falling back on Medicaid. And indeed, today, Medicaid pays something like 60% of nursing home stays.
Is this because it's so complicated? I read up on this a lot, and sometimes it says you absolutely should have it, and other times they're like, don't bother. So people don't know what to do.
Well, I think one of the problems with these issues of risk is the chance that you're actually going to be hit with these risks is relatively small. That's why we buy insurance. You know, for a relatively small premium, you can buy protection against these disaster scenarios. But because they are disaster scenarios, you know, in any given year, most of us do not crash our cars. We do not see our houses burn down. And fortunately, in most years, we don't die. As a consequence, these risks don't loom as large in our minds as they should. And so there's a temptation not to buy the insurance.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, the founder of HumbleDollar.com. As you mentioned, we pretty much have to have auto insurance and homeowners insurance, and we're supposed to have health insurance, but there are still some people who don't have it.
Yes, it seems that, you know, unless we're actually required to buy insurance, often we fail to do so. So if you have a house with a mortgage, the mortgage company is going to demand that you have homeowners insurance. If you have an automobile, in most states you are required to have car insurance. And so we're actually very good at protecting our property when it comes to cars and homes. When it comes to health insurance, as a result of the Affordable Care Act, you know, a lot of people have got health insurance in recent years. We've gone from having 16% of people without health insurance in 2010 down to 9% in 2017. But now that requirement to have health insurance has gone away, and you're no longer going to be penalized in 2019 if you don't have health care insurance, it'll be interesting to see whether we see the number creep back up.
Jonathan, let's talk about financial risks and where you should put your money. What is the advantage of mutual funds as opposed to stocking up on one or two stocks?
Well, the problem if you own one or two stocks is that, you know, you may be the person unfortunate enough to put all your money into Enron or to put all your money into MCI WorldCom and end up seeing your investment completely vaporized. To be well-diversified, you really need to own hundreds and hundreds of individual securities, and the only practical way to do that, if you're the typical small investor, is to do it with mutual funds. So sure, if you want to take a flyer on Amazon or you want to take a flyer on Apple, by all means, do it with a minority of your money. But the core of your portfolio should be mutual funds, because that's the best way to get the broad diversification that you need to ensure that you get something that looks like the broad market's return. Remember, what you don't want to happen is to take the risk of investing in the stock market and not get rewarded for it. If you want to be pretty sure of getting that reward, your best bet is to own mutual funds for the core of your portfolio.
Jonathan Clements, former personal finance columnist for The Wall Street Journal and the founder of the website HumbleDollar.com. It's 12 minutes before the hour. Coming up, why it's harder to find the hotel room you want. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. As travel websites get bigger, booking a decent hotel room is getting harder. Joining us to talk about the challenges of booking a hotel room is Rosie Spinks of Quartz. Rosie, what's wrong with sites like Booking.com or Hotels.com?
You know, it's really a matter of just the sheer amount of choice we have these days. If you're a frequent traveler, you're traveling for business, you're trying to book something quickly, you don't really necessarily want, you know, 30, 40, 50 options in the city that you're looking in. And that, you know, it can be helpful if you're trying to find a rock bottom price. But if you're trying to find something decent in your price range, it can be more helpful to have a sort of curated list of offerings. At least I find that.
Do Booking.com and Hotels.com trend toward vacationers?
I think these OTAs, as they're called, online travel agencies, their kind of goal is to get as many people as possible booking on their platform. So I wouldn't say that they specifically target vacationers. And when you think about it from a business perspective, that wouldn't be a great strategy, because business, you know, people go on vacation once a year, whereas business travelers travel all the time. So I think that's also a problem. You know, the type of hotel you might stay in for your vacation is different than what you would stay in for a business trip. So the way that so many hotels are lumped together on these OTAs can mean that what people really want is an experience that gives them less choice, but is more sort of tailored to their offerings, or for their that is more tailored to the kind of hotel they want.
So where should business travelers go to look for something a little bit faster?
You know, you can experiment with filters on these kinds of sites, but that's not always effective if the user design isn't quite up to par. There is Hotel Tonight is a platform that vets the hotels on its app and on its site. So you sort of know there's a baseline level of consideration that's gone into it before you have an opportunity to book it. But in my article, I was discussing how Airbnb had potentially been in talks, there were rumors of it, being in talks with Hotel Tonight for an acquisition, which kind of raises the question, you know, if Hotel Tonight were to be acquired by something like Airbnb, there would be fewer and fewer places to go to find somewhere to stay that doesn't offer you sort of all the choice in the world.
Rosie Spinks of Quartz. It's 7 minutes before the hour. Have a little cabin fever this winter? Researchers from the University of Regina in Saskatchewan have found that spending just 5 minutes in nature can quickly improve your mood. They conducted two studies before coming to this conclusion. In the first study, participants were assigned either to an outdoor or indoor location and asked to put away all electronic devices and focus on their setting while remaining seated for 5 minutes. Each person was then asked to scale a range of emotions that included comfort, pleasure, awe, gratitude, wonder, and a sense that you're part of something greater than yourself, both before and after being taken to each setting. When it came to emotions of comfort, those sitting outside experienced an increase before and after the test, while those in the indoor setting did not. When it came to emotions of awe and gratitude, those in the outdoor setting also experienced a greater increase than those inside. For the second study, researchers also included a scale for participants to score negative emotions, including stress, depression, and anxiety. That study also revealed that negative emotions were lowered in both settings. The conclusion? When you need an emotional boost, the fastest and easiest way is to spend a few minutes with nature. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.